I schedule everything. And I didn't like a couple years ago, I changed that phrasing and it's over and I'm like, nope, I make appointments for myself for everything. Cause they say like, well, how are you a architect, a builder, a real estate developer, a podcaster, teach at universities, run the nonprofit, have these kids, have a life. How do you do all this stuff? And I go, I carve out time for myself and I make it like a, my time allocation much more purposeful. You know, I kind of try, yes, I let like life pull me around here and there, but for the most part, I'm trying to I'm the one initiating how it all works.
Welcome everyone to another episode of Executive Health and Life. I'm your host, Julian Hayes II, back at it again. And I want to start off this episode with a quote from Tim Grover. And he said that if you can tolerate fear and doubt and loneliness, winning would like a word with you. And I like both his books. And I bring this up because during times of chaos, which 2024 may be that, according to some people, and but actually most likely it's going to be, or downturns like a recession, the typical response that a person will likely do is they're going to contract. They're going to hold on to whatever they have. But my guest today is someone who did the opposite, actually. Him and his business partner, after being laid off, they decided to start their own architectural firm in 2009 during the Great Recession. I'm sure there was a fair bit of mental chatter going on, to say the least. And present day, they have a beautiful new custom-built office. They have numerous accolades for their work. And what started as a team of two is now a team of 11. And they're just getting started. And my guest today is none other than Lance Keiko, who can simply be described as cool and calm. And he's pretty funny as well. And he's a serial entrepreneur, co-founder of F9 Productions, teaches part-time at the University of Colorado, and is the co-host of one of the top five architectural and business podcasts in the world called Inside the Firm. Without further ado, Lance, how's it going today?
Beautiful. It's going great. It's going great. Despite the sun surprisingly not shining in Colorado, it is still a beautiful day. I try to wake up every day and have that gratitude. You know, thank you, God, for this first breath, and then you go forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thankfully, I have beautiful sun here in Nashville, Tennessee, so there's no complaints on my end with that. It's a little cold for my liking, but it's probably not cold to you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm one of those crazy wackos who is addicted to ice fishing. And then, you know, going all the way up to like the Continental Divide, 11,000 feet in the air, and packing all my stuff up there just to catch some fish. So yes, I truly love the winter.
Yes. Speaking on that, as a guy who doesn't understand people who love the winter, but I am going to pick up a winter sport at some point. What's the fascination with fishing?
It's the easiest way for anybody, if they ever have tried it, to be as present as possible. It's meditation in real time. It really is, right? Especially if you're actually into it. Mm-hmm. And especially if, like, you know, you've got your line in the water or whatever, you're one-to-one with that line. Like, that's as close as you can get to nature. I mean, you are touching it at every moment. So I think that's, if I had to boil it down, it really is a meditative process for me.
I feel like it's a good dichotomy and contradiction between being an entrepreneur and then fishing, right? Because fishing, you probably used to going all the time, right? Whereas fishing, you have to really, I guess, slow down.
Yeah, 100%. And then there's, like, for me, there's the hike up and down. That's the really big part of it is, you're right. It's like, as an entrepreneur who's running multiple businesses, teaching actually at two universities now, with the nonprofit, all the other stuff that I do, you know, is I'm very extroverted Monday through Friday. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I've been emphasizing the last year now and this year is like this idea of the law of polarity, and that you got to have a positive and negative, and that's really about balance, right? Of like, okay, if I've extroverted all week, I think for me to be a healthy person and rebalance before the week starts again and have that energy to extrovert again all week, doing public appearances like this, all the things, I have to actually introvert during the weekend. And so I will go on these crazy hikes. The first hike we did this winter was on November 4th. It was one of my best fishing friends. His name is Eric. He's a couple years older than me. I'm 40. He's about 44. We hiked round trip to be the first people to ice fish in Colorado, 17 miles, up and down the mountains. The video actually went viral on YouTube on my fishing channel, Fishing with Lance. It's like first ice or something. Like, it's got almost 10,000 views. But that journey and not having any cell phone service, forcing myself to be completely detached from the matrix and the system is super important for me. And it really, I can tell, like at the end, I feel like at the end of the week, Monday through Friday, by the time Friday hits, I feel like I'm like kind of fragmented. Mm-hmm. Remember how you used to have to defrag computers if you were going to clean them up? That's how I felt like. I was like, oh my gosh, like I can feel like my energy and everything. I'm like defragmented and I need to refocus and center myself in that way. So it's really a top to bottom, especially the way I do it, where I'm hiking to these very, very remote places in the mountains and then coming back down. And I used to actually either listen to like a podcast while I was hiking. Mm-hmm. And I even stopped that now. And now it's just me and my footsteps. You know, even if I'm with a friend, like it's us and our footsteps. There's some talking and stuff like that, but it's very, we're trying to be one-to-one with the wind, our footsteps, you know, how if it rains on us, all of that kind of stuff.
Now, were you naturally extroverted, or did you have to teach yourself the skill to be extroverted? Which one did you kind of more gravitate to, or are you like a hybrid?
I would say a hybrid. The thing I had to force myself to do, though, as it relates to the extrovert, is when I was in college pursuing my bachelor's degree, there was an architecture school. There was one of my colleagues that I went to school with. His name is Justin, and he was he's not an architect now, so I can say this, and he's probably emotionally mature enough that if he ever heard this, he would be like, "Yeah, I agree." Mm-hmm. And that is, he wasn't a good architect. He wasn't a good designer. He was kind of a crap designer, actually. He would just do the work and get it done. But he had a gift, and whether it was natural or he really worked on it, didn't matter. He had it, and that was the gift of persuasion and public speaking. And what I watched him do is I watched like all of these introverted. There's a lot of introverts in the architecture and design world, right? The creative types, a lot of introversion there for sure. And I would watch those introverts be amazing artists, amazing designers, amazing architects, come up with like the most brilliant design solutions, super creative stuff, like almost inventing the wheel again type of like designs. And they would suck at selling them. And it was like, well, if you can't sell it to, you know, the critics, your teacher, the public, is it really worth it? Like, is it what? Cool, you got it done, but like, it's like a beautiful painting that nobody ever is going to buy because you were too big of a wuss or too scared to like put it in a public gallery and talk about your work or whatever, you know? Well, Justin would do the opposite. Not that good of a designer. And he would kind of do out these crap generic designs. But the way he sold them, I was like, oh my gosh, I can't do that yet. I should figure that out. So I really forced myself to try to become a better public persuader and a speaker. And part of that played into when we started teaching at the University of Colorado Boulder, you know, you would just try to give a good lecture and not use a lot of the uhs, ums, and ends, be smooth, be fluid, make people laugh, keep them engaged, especially in the technology age where like all the students are like TikTok, 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 you know, like they have that TikTok attention span. Like what a challenge to do. And then the show, the podcast actually, has really helped and emphasized with that too. Coming on shows like this, rewatching. I don't watch myself on interviews very often anymore, but I used to right away. And I was like, ooh, I need to stop doing those sorts of things because that's even distracting to me. And it's like cringy, right? Or you're like, oh, I'm cringy. I feel cringy. And the other part of that too is like, I believe in this 10,000 hours kind of effect, right? But for podcasting or public speaking, I feel like it's 100. For some reason, I just thought about 100 because we actually did a podcast before we did Inside the Firm podcast. It was called Driving to Work. And it was just a silly half comedy show. Me and Al were just talking, literally driving on the way to work and stuff like that. And I didn't stop hating the sound of my voice until episode 100. And also my cadence and everything like that. So I think those really helped me emphasize the extrovert part of it. And now I love when I have the mindset too of like, oh, it's Monday through Friday. I have to talk to people. I'm excited to talk to people. It's like super empowering to be charming. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Where you're going out and meeting like a potential client, and like you make them laugh, you make them smile and they feel good. such a cool feeling. Even if you don't get the work, you're like, yeah, I don't know, maybe I made their day by making them laugh in a certain way.
And the cool thing is, because I can relate to like all of this. This is why I was kind of smiling and laughing at the same time, is because I was the person for the longest time. I did not like my voice. Even hearing it, it sounded too prim and proper to me, right?
Yeah.
And eventually you come to a point where you do it enough. And then when it comes to persuasion and being charming, you start to see that there's different ways to be charming. You don't have to be the comedian. There's different methods and styles. Just like, you know, you can have the guy who's just a hot guy and he's super buff and all that. And that's his way, right? And then the other guy is a comedian, right? And that's his skill, right? And it's the same thing in this, is that I'm still learning this, right? Because and the podcast has helped with this. You're talking to different people. A lot of times you haven't really met them up until you hit record. And so you're learning, how do you quickly build rapport? How do you quickly just, you know, create a conversation that flows back and forth? All these little skills. Because at first, like I was the opposite of that guy. I focused on, I was like, I know all this health information, all these biohacks, all these different tools. I have all these cool tests and everything, but I have no, you know, but it doesn't matter if you don't know how to communicate. It doesn't matter how much you know. And that's a very good entrepreneur lesson that I didn't learn for the longest, is that you got to have some skill, but really, you really got to know how to communicate and persuade. And I think this is kind of a lesson from Tesla's days, Nikola Tesla, right?
Mm.
And that was one of his big downfalls, is that he was way smarter than, I believe it was Edison around there as well. But Edison was much more of an entrepreneur and a communicator.
Yep.
And he got all the accolades instead of Tesla.
Yeah. That's what's so funny about Elon. Mm-hmm. It's like, Elon is awkwardly charming. So I don't know, you know. Oh, he's admitted he's on the spectrum, right? Mm-hmm. And at the same time, he's a genius. He has to be very high IQ because he's on the spectrum. So like all the things line up and all that. And like, it's not that he's when he's giving his presentations on like, oh, unveiling the Cybertruck or the new Tesla model, whatever, any of that kind of stuff. It's not so much that he's like handsome and charming and like the traditional ways you would think of somebody being persuasive. It's almost like the crutch that holds him back is the one that helps him out too, and he just embraced that sort of that awkwardness in that kind of way. So I appreciate that about even a guy like, what I'm trying to get at is like, it seems like anybody can do it if they have to recognize like who they are, like you said, Julian. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe you're not the most handsome, or maybe you don't like, or maybe there's a, you know, you just don't have the certain skills that other people do. Fine, God gave you some kind of gifts. Like, you just got to find out what those are.
Yeah. And I think, like I said, everyone has a superpower. And, you know, speaking of that, you're a serial entrepreneur yourself. And so if I go back to 10-year-old Lance, would I be surprised, or would this all make sense of where you are right now?
My grandma would say, but that's, you know, my grandma's probably believed in me more than anybody in that kind of regard, in that she, you know, would say from day one, yeah, that everything Lance is doing doesn't surprise me. Like, she's always believed me in that kind of way. But I don't, I think she's probably one of the few ones, right? But then again, it's like, okay, it's grandma saying that and all that kind of stuff. I don't know, actually, because I think I'm one of the very rare people out of where I grew up in to be able to make it this far and multiply in this kind of way, 12 hours away from home. It's very difficult to move to a place where you don't know anybody. You have hardly any connections. I mean, almost none, besides that first job I got, and then be able to start an architecture firm, which is a very highly competitive environment. Super. Everybody wants to be an architect, right? And I don't like absolute language using it too often, but people have thought about it, right? It sounds like a fun profession. I get to draw buildings. I get to be creative. Mm-hmm. You know, like George Costanza, right? Remember, he wanted to be an architect even. So really, my journey with all of that didn't start until I was about 13. And it started to click for me in that kind of way. The best part about, I think, the journey so far is, especially kind of in these later years, as we become seasoned, is I will get calls, texts, emails, people reaching out from that hometown and asking me for advice. And they will, and the phrase they use where I'm like, ooh, I think it probably is reinforcing that maybe I'm one of the very few ones to kind of get out of that area in this entrepreneurial way, is they say, I don't know anybody else who even does as many, I don't know anybody else who's successful in the kind of way you are. And so around here, so I'm calling you to see if I can pick your brain for a little bit, and glean some information from you. And I'm just like, that's way better. Like when I get those calls, I am so much, the kind of feeling I get is way better than any kind of money I've ever gotten paid ever. Or even any kind of like awards are close to it, but those kind of reach outs by people are, I'm like, ooh, I'm like literally touching like the nerve of the universe and the energy and tweaking it.
Yeah. That's interesting. I want to, let's backtrack and let's go back to the actual inception of this whole thing in 2009. And when that hits you, and I guess, how do you even like come to this idea? Is it more of a, I don't want this to happen again, so I'm going to take my fate into my own hands? Or is it a thing of desperation, or I can't find another job? I guess, what's the mindset around that?
It's both of those things. Yeah, it was a really good comprehensive view of the whole thing. Yeah, it was exactly that. So to paint the picture, everybody, what Julian's talking about is in 2009, if you're not old enough to remember or something like that, or you were just asleep then, like that was the height of the Great Recession, right? And the sector of the economy that got hit the most and the hardest was inarguably the architecture, engineering, and construction community, because it was the housing boom. It was the housing bubble, boom and bust. So obviously then real estate and that whole sector was the worst off. 50% of architects were laid off during that time. 50% of them were laid off. So there were no jobs. So when I got laid off and Alex got laid off, it was a push come to shove, where it was like, I had two children that time. And I said, well, I'm not going back to North Dakota. I love it in Colorado. Like, this is my dream to live here. I have no choice but to find my own work. And I had, Alex had always been able to find his own work in that kind of way too. So that's half the problem. And I'm so glad. I don't even think anybody's ever asked me that before, of like, was the other reason you started because you wanted to make sure that never happened to you again? Yes. It was about control. Mm-hmm. And it really was a modern stoic approach to the whole situation. And this was before I even got into like stoicism and had read Marcus Aurelius and meditations and understood what a modern day stoic really does. And that is, if you believe in that philosophy and you try to live a life like that, it's, I'm here, I'm present, I'm in this situation, what are my chess moves, right? And what I tell to a lot of people that listen to our show, or when I do podcasts like this, like, we're both millennials here. Maybe your audience is too. And there's maybe some Gen Zs listening and stuff like that. Like, in Western society, there's a problem right now. And it's like a mind virus that is victimhood. And I really hate it, because like, I'm technically a minority. I was I'm a federally registered Native American who grew up in a rural North Dakota on this sort of like, even worse than a reservation in a way, because we were still Native Americans, but we didn't get the kind of subsidies that like other Native Americans do, because we were like this leftover piece of land and people. So even more forgotten than like the Native Americans, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, I recognize I was born in that way. And you know what? The analogy I make all the time to people is with this chessboard, and stoicism is like, you hear it all the time in the media or wherever, and people are saying, well, we're just pawns. Good. Because guess what happens when you're the pawn and you get all the way to the other side of the board? You can become the queen. And the queen is the most powerful piece on the board. Or you can resurrect another piece too. Like, you're so powerful. It's the same thing with like these, like, people are like, well, I was dealt a crappy hand of cards. Good. Guess why that's a positive thing? Because like, let's say, for example, When I went to school at North Dakota State, one of the big stark differences I noticed is when I went, the high school I went to was, I graduated with like 20 people, super small. Yeah. Very rural town of 500. So my choices were very limited on the classes I could take. In fact, there was pretty much no electives. I couldn't take any of these AP level college courses. I frankly, the teachers weren't as good as they would have been maybe if I would have went to a larger school. And so my counterparts, a lot of them, on the other side of the state, they came from like big cities in Minneapolis, big suburbs, and they would go to school with like 350 people. And I go, okay, they were dealt and educate, and they would come to North Dakota State and they already have AP classes done. they didn't have to take the remedial algebra course that I had to take because the teacher just, in my opinion, wasn't good in high school and I couldn't pick another one. And it was, okay, they were dealt, let's say, a hand of aces. Cool. I was dealt a very crappy poker hand. No problem. Guess what? We're still all playing poker. We're still all playing, right? And in fact, maybe if I play mine, now the challenge is for me, somebody like me in my position, this is where the anti-victimhood should come through for everybody, is like, I have to play my hand almost perfectly. I have to really play my hand smart. And if I do that and I end up getting eventually a hand of aces, and now I'm caught up to the other people, how much more strong is my brain with because I had to go through that exercise? Mm-hmm. I'm probably actually at a bigger advantage now because I crushed it. Thank God for that negativity. Like, thank God for that bad part of being dealt in that way. Like, that's anti-victimhood.
A lack of, you know, and this reminds me of kind of this thing that a lack of resources is a benefit to you because you're going to have to be resourceful and really build up your skill. And it's almost like the thing, this is kind of a different analogy. It's, and I told my, I have a friend, he's around 20. And I guess I'm a mentor now, which is, it's kind of weird because I don't really think I'm there. But I was telling him that, look, man, you're kind of at this stage, right? And so you're kind of at the awkward stage, right? But it's good. You don't want to peak too early. So it's good to have, I don't think you want to be the super hot guy in high school and peak through there. You know, you want to be the scrawny guy to no one, because that's kind of how I was. And then eventually you come into your own form and you really had to build yourself up. Then you're going to be a much more well-rounded man because you don't have to rely on your looks. You have communication. You build up all these different kinds of skills. So it's kind of the same domain in this area. And back to the 2009 thing. The reason why I asked that question is because for me, I was kind of asleep. And that was my wake-up call. I was just getting done with college. And both my parents were laid off then. And they were blue-collar jobs. And I was like, I was confused at first because they're hard workers. They're hard workers. They went to work sometimes sick, never missed a day, didn't complain of nothing, just did their job. And then they were one of the first people to go. And I didn't know it in that moment. But when I really thought about it, I was like, that's where it started. Because that taught me then that, you know, just because you work hard doesn't mean you're guaranteed security. And security is oftentimes an illusion.
Yep.
And so I didn't jump into being an entrepreneur then. I still went to grad school, medical school, but then I left medical school after the first year and then finally got into this whole adventure. But that was kind of my moment of waking up, because up until that point, I was just coasting. I didn't live a rough life, didn't live a super rich life, but it was just in the middle. And the middle is sometimes the most dangerous, as I tell people, because life is just good enough to where you don't just have just that killer instinct to improve. And it's not so bad that you just really have to improve. Right. Yeah. So
where would Michael Jordan be if he didn't get cut from the team?
That's true.
You know, it's like, oh my gosh, I just love that. But I love any kind of time where I like, and that's why I usually have folks like that have experienced grit on our show. You know, I want to hear that negative part. Tell me about that negative part and how you turned it around. Thank God for that negative part every single time.
Yeah. And I think sometimes another thing is people tend to shy away from, like, some people say the dark side or that thing that really just makes you angry and gets you into action. But I think, you know, at least when you're first getting started, you got to use whatever kind of inspiration, motivation you got. And for most people, it's proving a point or going against someone. Or I think there's a book out now called Choose Your Own Enemies. And that's, you know, picking an enemy out there. An enemy could be victimhood, an anti-capitalist mindset, whatever it is.
Yep.
Whatever gets you going, I think you got to use that. And so one of the things, still staying around the 2009-2010 range, is I imagine when you're doing something like this, and like you said, there's not a lot of people who are doing this entrepreneurship thing. Did you have any naysayers or doubts? And if you did, how'd you handle that?
Oh yeah, all my colleagues, almost every single one of my colleagues, right? They were very focused on, see, because when we started the firm inside, when we started F9 Productions, we actually couldn't even call ourselves architects for like the first 3 or 4 years, because we had to figure out creative ways of, by partnering with other architects that were licensed and working with them and having them review our work and doing all these other things in the legalese of it all to then get the amount of points we needed to be able to then take our tests and get licensed. And then we could finally call ourselves architects. So like it was actually even, so not only was there not, there no work, right? Hardly any work. There was that too. There was the protectionism that we had to break through, the state enforced protectionism that we had to break through in all that kind of way. But we persevered. We did it and all of that. But that was the biggest pushback we got was actually from my contemporaries, right? The people I graduated with. And they were very focused on the licensure part of it. And I don't fault them for that. It makes sense, right? Because you like, if you're going to be the perfect Boy Scout and you can, if you could write out exactly how your life is going to, should go, like that would be how, probably how you'd write the sequence. Like, oh, no, I did it exactly perfectly. I went and got licensed and then I started my business and I had all these clients to begin with. And that's not the way life works, right? Like life is like, we're navigating this chaos every single day, right? And we're trying to, especially as an entrepreneur, like you can't control the macro economy. You can only control your micro economy. You know, back again to the stoicism, like what can I control in my life and make it work and like navigate through that whole chess game. What's hilarious about it now is, and I kind of knew this was going to happen, is so Alex and I would have essentially started the firm when I was 27 and he was 25, and I'm 40 now. And now in this last year, I can count probably five or six of my colleagues that are calling me for advice who were poo-pooing the whole thing from the beginning. Hey, when you guys started the firm, what'd you guys do? Did you do this, that, and the other, blah, blah, blah. And I don't have any, there's no negativity because I'm like, I'm trying to have this sort of zen-like look at it where it's like, I could regurgitate that negativity and like push it back on them, but like, no, I'm supposed to be the bigger person here and that guiding, helping force for them. And like, that's part of my path that God gave me is like, I'm supposed to be a bigger, better person in that kind of way and more empathetic. They're reaching out to you for a reason that is a very honorable thing. And it probably took them guts to do it. Honestly, if I really have the true empathy thought pattern here, it's like, I bet they were kind of a little sheepish to come back to us and ask for all this advice. Mm-hmm. I've got one guy who calls me every single week. His name is Nate. And I don't think he'll be embarrassed by me telling him that, citing his name and name dropping or anything like that. If he happens to listen to this show, he calls me every week now. And it's awesome. Because now I get there. And now the way I look at it positively, I'm like, besides all the other stuff is I go, well, I get to talk to my best friends like every week. That's cool. Like how many, like I have so many friends. I tell my daughter sometimes, I'm like, she's like, well, I'm just afraid of you growing and becoming an old man alone. And I'm like, you're Kaya. Like I have too many friends. If anything, I have too many friends. It's a lot. Sometimes I have to push the ignore button because it's just too much. So,
Yeah. You know, and, you know, speaking of, you know, probably for entrepreneurs in that industry and even outside at the early beginning stages, getting some of those first wins. And I'm sure sometimes there's a little doubt or uncertainty, not that you can do the job, or maybe sometimes it is that you can do the job, or, and there's a lot of just talk going on. Mm-hmm. So what do you say to someone who, there's not really a better word to use than quote unquote imposter syndrome and going out there and getting those first wins and kind of having this conflict, like, I know I can do the job, but I don't have the quote unquote physical proof yet, but I know I can do the job and I know I'm skilled enough.
Yeah, I know. I get why you had a little hesitation with that phrase, imposter syndrome. I know, because there's a negative connotation with it, right? Like I was thinking while you were saying that, I was like, is there something I can come up with that would be better? And the only thing I come up with is like fake it till you make it, which is not maybe not even better. Because it sounds negative too. And because it makes it seem like if we say those things, yeah. Julian, and people are listening to us and they're like, so you, isn't that unethical? Like you didn't know what you're doing? No. We're just trying to describe that we're maybe in those early years of entrepreneurship, you're extending yourself, maybe just you're getting a little bit further out on your skis than is comfortable. And that's okay, right? But it's just like working out. So last year I stopped doing push-ups about the second half last year. And I was like, I regretted it every day. I was like, I should just start doing it again. And then, you know, and then this new year, now I do every other day and I started doing them again. I'm like, oh yeah, I love feeling strong. I just love that pump. And the best part about it is, like, yes, there's the pump. So that's the positive part. Like, oh, I feel a little bit bigger. Like right now, I feel a little bit bigger because I just did them. And I'm going to go to a meeting. I'm going to feel nice and, you know, like a man. But the real part that I like is the negative soreness afterwards. I actually really enjoy. I'm like, oh, yeah, that soreness the next day, because it just feels good to me, because I know that, like, I kind of tore my muscles a little bit. And they're going to get, hopefully, if I keep doing it, then they'll get stronger. And, like, that's the part that makes it out. So you can't build muscles, right? Mm-hmm. Business or physical, unless you get a little uncomfortable. So you really have to embrace that uncomfortability feeling that you get when you're kind of getting a little bit over your skis. That's okay. I want to really emphasize to everybody is not everybody knows how to do every single thing. And one of the real true signs of maturity that I've noticed in the past maybe 5 years, now that I feel like we are a seasoned company, and I'm a true real adult, is because I have all these people reaching out to me with, like, and we have enough experience, is I go, it only occurred to me in the last 5 years where I felt real comfortable saying, answering questions with, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And like being happy about it and sort of going like, and like having no embarrassment about it. Super empowering and super emotionally mature when you reach that tipping point as a young professional or leader, when you go, I don't know, but let's find out, let's figure it out. People, sometimes that's more reassuring. I mean, one of the things I hate most in life is like liars. Anybody who lies in that kind of way, I'm like, 'cause it's going to come out. Right. And so that's I think where I go with if it's okay, you're in the moment, it's all good. Like, embrace that sort of getting just a little bit about further where you need to be.
Yeah, you know, on a couple of your other interviews I listened to, you talk a lot about discipline, equaling freedom. And what juncture of life did this first come up that you really needed to start really implementing this?
Second year of architecture school. That's when actually it would have been, second year of architecture school, because then I'm in the studio working, yeah. And that's when I embraced being a morning person. And that's where the discipline really started. That's when I started to notice, if I got up and I'm at the design studio in college before anybody else is, then I can, it's quiet, the creative zen-like openness that your mind needs to be able to go in and out while you don't have all this interference. I like to call them the golden hours. So like, and how that's, so my, and then that routine has evolved. I've kept that routine my whole life. I was usually the first one at the studio and maybe the last one to lead or to leave. And then I started doing extra stuff like that, where I used to say, I schedule everything. And I didn't like, a couple of years ago, I changed that phrasing and it's over. And I'm like, nope, I make appointments for myself for everything. Cause they say like, well, how are you a architect, a builder, a real estate developer, a podcaster, teach at universities, run the nonprofit, have these kids, have a life. How do you do all this stuff? And I go, I carve out time for myself, and I make it like my time allocation much more purposeful. You know, I kind of try, yes, I let like life pull me around here and there, but for the most part, I'm the one initiating how it all works. Right. And what that's translated to now, like jump all the way ahead to from, you know, I don't know, 20 years ago when that second year of studio would have been, is now my morning routine is wake, big glass of water, stretch, pray the rosary for some other people that maybe just some other kind of form of meditation, put the coffee on, and I'm doing that by 5:30 or 6, and then 2 golden hours, hopefully, before the rest of the world gets up, the emails come out, and then that's where the growth really happens and the creativity happens again. Because as soon as those other emails start flying, then that's where I start getting like, oh, it's pulling me apart a little bit. Like I was centered and now I'm pulled apart a little bit, and I have to deal with all that chaos throughout the day, you know, and then I'm done dealing with that chaos. And then I kind of recalibrate for that night, repeat Monday through Friday. And then we already kind of talked about, you know, the whole week and going from extrovert to introvert.
You know, I'm going to go to another point now. I saw something interesting, and I was curious to know the answer on this. And you mentioned, and you were discussing architects and the benefits that they bring to business owners. So
yeah,
let's dive into that a little bit. I'm just curious on this.
So the biggest thing I can, I'm trying to speak to the medical person in you right now, like there's the American Association of Medical, something like that, right? Like these governing bodies, right? Well, ours is for architects is the American Institute of Architects. My biggest problem with them is that like, I'm still having to describe to the general public what an architect does. Right. Mm. And so that's what I'm going to do now is like, this will enter at least one business person's ear in there as they listen to this, and maybe it'll hopefully help their business. And the biggest thing is it pretty much costs you nothing to reach out to an architect right away in the process of if you are thinking about signing a lease and you're going to open up that first storefront, you're thinking about buying a piece of land, building your house, you're thinking about doing something building wise, design wise to property either you own or you're going to lease or whatever. And don't be afraid to do that, because a lot of times if you can find the right architect, somebody like me, and it might take maybe two or three calls, because maybe the first two are just like, oh, this sounds like a consultation meeting. That costs $150 or something like that. But if a lot of times I get these calls from people, for instance, they're looking at a storefront, right? And one of the first things I ask them is I go, have you signed the lease yet? And lately I've been hearing a lot of no. And I go, oh, good. And they go, why? And I go, okay, I just want to paint the picture for you, just so you make sure you're prepared when you sign this lease, so you don't set yourself up for failure. That's, I think, the thing that first and foremost is not, it's not actually about the design stuff. It's about the information that an architect knows about the design, the securing property process, the design process, the construction process, and rolled into all of that is how long it takes to get something permitted and built. Because what architects are doing is, if they're somebody like me who really believes in the truth, and like, even if I'm going to tell you the truth, even if you don't like it, like that's your fault. If you don't like the truth, I'm going to tell the truth. And so they'll tell me, oh yeah, I haven't signed a lease yet. And I'll go, oh, perfect. Perfect. What do you have for your what do you have for your set aside in the lease right now before you have to start paying rent? Because I know what it's like to start a business. Like, every penny up at the beginning is like, you're just, it's a problem. Until you get that financial freedom, you know, you really don't move in a flow state direction. And, you know, let's say they say, oh, we got 30 days. And I go, oh, well, did your realtor tell you to do that? And they go, usually they say yes. And I go, okay, here's the perspective I come from. I'm here to tell you the truth. Your realtor is just trying to get you to sign the lease. And so you see 30 days and you start thinking, yep, oh yeah, well, I'll be up and running in 30 days. Cash flow is going to get going. Like, I need to move that kind of fast. And what I end up having to tell them is I have to tell them kind of a week by week process of, here's how it's going to work. You sign the lease, we start design. It's going to take me and the engineers this long. We submit it to the building department. They're going to take forever because that's how the government works. There's no way around it. Doesn't matter if it's red, white, blue, up or down, left or right. It's the government. It sucks. And then it can change their lease time just for this one example and save them from having to pay rent before the thing is built. Because a realtor, again, wants to, let's get this signed. Like, that's their objective. Well, my objective is vastly different than them. That's one example. And so you could extrapolate that to whatever kind of thing you're thinking about building is like, just go ask an architect, hey, what is the process like from obtaining the property to designing it to building it? How long is it really going to take? And let's say you don't like architect A's answer. You call three of them, A, B, C. Fine, call B, get their answer too. Fine, call C, get their answer too. You're not actually asking them to do any design work. You're just asking them about what's the process like. That's a pretty cut and dry sort of thing. So I don't know if you're expecting me to say anything like design wise, how it changes them. That's a whole different thing. I actually think it starts with that information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's interesting. I didn't think we were going to go that angle, but it makes a lot of sense. Yeah. I thought we were I guess most people will start with the design, but really, I guess yep. What you just described is really actually the actual foundation, not the design itself, but it's
100%.
It's the step before the actual design.
Yeah, I'm trying to expose their like the minefield for them, you know? And sometimes my conversations with them get a little overwhelming and I can hear them like, not drooling, but like just they're it's too much. You can see them like short circuiting in real life. And I go, okay, I'll slow down. I'm happy to have you take notes. And then almost every time they go, oh yeah, that'd be great. Could you pause? And then they take the notes. And there are clients I've talked to that have called me like, you know, in 2020 and asked me that question. And then 3 or 4 years later, they reach back out and go, okay, we're finally ready. Cool. Like, wow, did that really hurt me in the end? Because that's the thing about like almost any business, I feel like you are playing 18 holes of golf. You're not playing one. You have to have this perspective of 18 holes. We're playing a very long game in this kind of way. And yes, once you get to like that 18th hole and let's say you master that game, okay, trust me, like it'll make up for it on the back end of the next game of golf because maybe you're just hitting hole in one, birdie, hole in one, you know?
You know, speaking of a process, any recommendations when it comes to kind of scaling your firm and some of the steps that you took to go about that methodically? Because, you know, it's not like this is a product. This is a service. So I think the principles of scaling will be a little different.
Yeah. I can actually relate this back to both the firms that we have. So we have the architecture firm, which is F9 Productions. We have the construction firm. And remember, I'm speaking about like a very specific sector of the economy, right? But I wonder how this translates to other people. Because maybe it could translate to if you have somebody who's thinking about starting a graphic design business or some other service-based business where there's a project, right? Mm-hmm. And what we've noticed is the best way to scale safely is slow and steady. And so the for an architect side of things is I need to have 3 projects at the beginning of a week that I just signed that I cannot assign to a current staff member because they are too far out with their current schedule. Meaning for us, that would be, oh, I couldn't get one of my other associates who's already employed with us to touch the project for 4 weeks. And 2 weeks would be acceptable for me because I can make a client. I have trouble convincing clients, you got to wait a month. 2 weeks, they can bite off and chew. They get that. Like, because there's a psychology behind it. It's like, oh, I can wait a couple of weeks. That word is very important, right? Same thing with construction projects is if I have like 3 houses currently that we're building, and my construction foreman is tapped out. Like that's all he can do per week. He can't go visit another site. There's not a 4th one. No problem. Then I know that I might be able to expand here. Like I might be able to either move one of the other guys up to a foreman position or hire somebody new. Same thing with the architecture side of things. That's how we just made our last hire, Jake. And that's kind of how we consistently have done it. I also like the idea that maybe you're only hiring in a service-based business, especially if you're trying to do what we do and have done, which has earned us the top-rated customer service architecture firm in Colorado, is to provide that level of high-quality customer service where we do things like return phone calls, emails, texts within 1 hour, 24 hours at the latest, stuff like that, rapid communication, open, honest stuff like that is, I need to grow slow and steady. And I think if you start, because it's hard, you really want to train people, you know, correctly. So that first hire, if that helps your audience be less scared, that's the trigger point. I think it's got to be 3 or more projects that even if you're a sole proprietor, you know, look at your own schedule and like you're a cake baker and you're like, I'm booked for a month, but I have all these orders. Yeah, maybe it's time to start hiring somebody else. Then you got to start thinking about also then the system. So you have to repeat yourself or you have to be comfortable enough and mature enough to be able to go, I'm okay with delegating the work to one of my employees. But the thing you have to make sure you have set up for yourself is like a clean, solid training system. Mm-hmm. Even if it means, and a lot of architects or designers or people get tempted if they hire somebody, they're like, okay, I got to pay this person. if it's their first employee and they, you know, they're nervous about that and payroll and everything, and they're like, they got to be doing work immediately. No. For us, you don't do work for 3 days. That is billable. We're going to train you in our system with our software, with all the videos we develop internally and for that. And I am going to lose money for 3 days. But guess what happened most recently with Jake? I just checked in with him. He's only been working here for about 6 weeks. On his third project, he hit perfect profitability per an hourly rate after you divide the whole thing up. And I was like, ooh, this guy's on track. Like the methodology is working in that kind of way. When you get to multiple expansions, so let's say now you're 10 years in the future, like kind of we are, and you've got, I like to really make the metaphor of a cake. Like you've built a cake. So at the top, you have the CEOs and the owners. And then since we've been doing it for 10 years, right, we've got senior staff and we've got junior staff. And then at the very bottom, we've got entry level staff. If you're really trying to do that high level of customer service and or product, the top layer of the cake still needs to talk to the bottom level of the cake. Because how did the cake even get to that expansive point? It started with when it was very small. The top was always talking to the bottom. And that's one of the big, we actually tried to experiment with not doing that for the last 2 years. It was a giant failure for the last two folks that we hired who then ended up going their separate ways on their own accord. And then it was like, oh, yep, top layer still got to talk to the bottom layer. And I feel like that's kind of, for us, our most recent evolution in running successful businesses.
Okay. And so I want to move to the topic of AI. You know, AI is, of course, in my industry, it's a really cool test. And things that I'm already using now with this. And so I'm curious, how's AI kind of infiltrating your industry?
A lot of people immediately jumped on the, we're going to use ChatGPT to write blogs. And they could spit out all of this information right away. But what you started to notice with the AI is like ChatGPT, for example, is it just repeats information too much. And so it does and then I think where everybody ended up last year, at the end of last year, so that discussion started literally at the beginning of 2023 in some of these forums that I'm in with a bunch of other architects, thousands of architects. And then at the end, it sort of evolved to, yeah, it shouldn't be writing all of your articles word for word. What it should be doing, or blogs or whatever, what it should be doing is, it's a good at idea generation. Like it'll give you, let's say you said, like, give me 10 ideas for 2024 to write blogs on different topics that are popular according to the most popular SEO words on Google, whatever. It does a really good job at that. And then maybe it can go one step further and give you like paragraph topics for each of it. So it's giving you a little bit more developed outline. Mm-hmm. And that's how I've used it for our blogs after going through that kind of evolution. So it is a useful tool in that kind of way. Visually, it's is where it's really kind of the rubber's hitting the road and people are using it a lot. So the renderings, the photorealistic renderings that we used to produce in college, you know, in 2008, it would take a day to do one still just to have the machine render it all. That was after we've been modeling in the program for days, weeks, whatever. And then we'd have to do another day of Photoshop on top of that. And now it's like seconds and minutes, and the iterations are crazy fast. You know, the variables are there in a much better way. But design wise, it's not quite there yet. You know, it's not laying out rooms or anything like that. Like there's some clunky attempts at it. It kind of reminds me of, like, you've probably seen like the AI images of just people, mm-hmm. and you can tell when it's an AI every time because you go, got the fingers wrong.
Fingers.
Like, yep. Every time. And it's kind of like art. Like, I know when I was, I had to take a couple art classes in college, and it was, our teacher we would have to draw figures or whatever. And almost every student would struggle with the hands. I don't know why. And it was like, he would come by and he would tap our hand after, if he saw a bad hand, and he'd go, flippers, flippers. Because for some reason, so it's like, yes, AI was built by us. So then it's got to have these weird characteristics too, of like, it can't produce hands. So that's kind of the quickest way I can summarize how it's affecting the AEC community. what I hope it does, if I could just one last thing, like what I hope it does is, because this would be better for everybody, including just the consumer side of things. I already talked about the big gummed up situation. You submit a set of building plans to the government. They take forever to approve it. It's a huge problem. I would love it if AI started doing the plans review and eliminating the bureaucrat, and we just get it done. Because, like, from a standpoint of what is the point of the plans review, they claim, everybody on both sides of the coin, architects and the building plans reviewers, is health, welfare, and safety. Cool. I think we can all agree on that. Mm-hmm. And it's built upon codes, right? So can we get a program where that's what it cares about? It, like, because they actually don't comment on the design of, like, oh, this doesn't look pretty. No, that's not their job. You know, their job is to just cross-check, like, did we make the hallway wide enough to get the people out of the building during a fire? Stuff like that. That's where I hope it goes. Like, if I was – I'm not about to start any new companies anytime soon, because I'm still trying to make sure the construction side gets to year 7, and then we – you know, everybody knows what happens. You get to year 7, then you kind of made it. Your chances of failing are much, much less as every year goes on and stuff like that. But if there was, maybe when I'm 50 or sooner, or, you know, if I get the construction company going a little bit more automated, it would be like, I would love to go after venture capital and try to do that and replace building plans reviewers. I would hope, and then it would make them very scared, and maybe they would do their job. Screw it. That would be just like, oh, then you just, maybe this just makes you do your job better. So
yeah, they don't have any competition. So
yeah,
it's like airlines in Europe compared to airlines in the States, right? There's a reason why there's so many cheaper airlines over there compared to here, is because there's competition. It's really a monopoly over here. Mm-hmm. Not officially, yep. But it's pretty much, for all intents and purposes, a monopoly.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm with you.
So as we get ready to wrap this down, I have a few just kind of random questions now. And so the first one is, what do you enjoy most about podcasting?
Oh, man, the flipping of perspectives, hearing something I hadn't heard, usually when I'm interviewing people. But then also, I think even hearing myself say something that I wasn't expecting. So this last year in 2023 was actually the year I did the most public appearances on podcasts. I think I did maybe 30 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I found myself saying things where I was like, huh, did that come from my subconscious? Like, at a certain level, you're having to keep talking, right? We don't want dead air. There's that whole, you know, just basic radio/podcast mantra and everything. That's been the most exciting part to me. And then coupled with that, then I would get some authors on our show, and they would mid-book or like mid-interview. One most recent one, I can't remember her, the author's name, but the book is called Holding the Calm. I was so sold on the book. While she was talking about halfway through, I go, I just picked up the book, by the way, because I was so sold by it. So I get these beautiful recommendations that I would have never even known about until I interviewed that person. So
I'm going to check that book out. Holding the Calm.
Holding the Calm.
I like that name. Yeah.
Life changer. Yeah.
I'm going to go check that out as well. And so the next question is, how do you separate your identity from work? And I think this is especially important when you are in the earlier stages of your entrepreneurship journey.
You mean just identity, like as a man, as a
I'll give you an example. So I'll interject myself a little bit. So
okay,
when you're at the early stages of your entrepreneur journey, you have this big idea in your head, right? You can see the vision, right? But say there's a gap between where you are and where you need to go, right? Okay. And that bridge hasn't been built yet. And sometimes we tend to equate our self-worth to what we have achieved so far, right? So, like, you know, for me, I played sports and academics. You had all these accolades, right? And that was probably not the best thing to have your self-worth on. But we tend to put a lot of our worth in external things. And so in entrepreneurship, that's not the best idea, because it can take a while to see certain things come to fruition.
Yeah. Now I go. I see where you're going with this. So when I graduated from architecture school, I graduated number one. And I won what was called the Peter F. McKinsey Award. And that means you have the best thesis, you're the best designer. like you are the best designer for sure. And it went even for a little bit further where it was, we got a program got accredited that year, national accreditation, and they rank the universities, architecture schools specifically with that accreditation. They ranked us at number 17. So you can imagine what my ego was coming out of school, right? And I got all these interviews with the top architecture firms in Colorado, very prestigious places like Aspen, Boulder, and all of that. And so then when we started the firm, I, you know, still think, oh yeah. I mean, even today where I go like, no, I'm a good architect. Eventually, hopefully I'll be a great architect, like a Frank Lloyd Wright. I'm a good designer and I think I'm the best, right? I still think I have this mentality of I'm the best. So that was a difficult part thing to let go of, was for me to go, at a certain point, I have to be comfortable delegating the design work so that people can get into their flow state when they work for us and be as autonomous as possible. Because that's where designers really get into a flow state and are most happy and do the best work. Is you can't like stand over the top of people and micromanage their designs. It's interesting because this is part of the evolution. Like this is what you keep doing. If you are trying to be a good entrepreneur, a great entrepreneur, and serial entrepreneur too, and try to repeat that, because like it's one thing to start one company and for it to be successful. It is a whole nother thing when you're starting 2, 3, 4. That's why a guy like Elon Musk is so impressive. For me, I'm like, I don't think people understand how difficult it is to start one, let alone all those. Like, it's amazing that they crush, right? And so in the evolution of all of this is, you know, Alex and I would do all the design work right away because it was just us two. Then we had to get comfortable delegating it out for like 7 to 10 years, right? And now the final evolution is, and our theme for this year, or the big thing that Alex and I are trying to re-energize back into F9 is, hey, I think we're established. I think it's obvious, right? We won that Best of Mile High award. We are almost to the first page of Google when you just search organically, like Colorado architect, Colorado commercial architect, that sort of thing. We paid a lot of money to get there with our marketing firm and stuff. But it's like, I think we are missing and losing some opportunities and really trying to be and produce, even on the smallest project in the firm, could be kitchen remodel. Is this the best possible design it can be? And so we're going to read, every year we try to read a book, and this year is going to be a Pattern Language by Christopher Alexander. And so now I'm having to figure out how to not be dictatorial, but I guess more inspiring in that way of like, guys and gals, I want us to be the number one design firm as well in Colorado. And it just never stops. Like the leveling up never stops. And I hope my staff doesn't get exhausted by it, but like this is what, if you're a good leader, this is what you have to do. You have to constantly challenge your team in a positive way.
I love all of that. One of the last questions here is, what does success mean to you?
Success to me is when, even if you have a theory or an idea and you want to test it, and it doesn't matter if it's a personal idea and it's maybe something you've never done, or a business idea, is if it works. And it actually doesn't have to work in the way that you thought it was going to work. And the working could even be like, was it a successful failure? That's a thing that can totally happen and be, you know, in existence, right? But like, what happened after the failure? Like, did I learn from that failure? So the success is just, is when you can see the positive, and whether it's negative or positive. Positive is just obvious, right? Mm-hmm. But maybe the real big one is like, was that a successful failure? Like, what does that mean? It reminds me of like when I just started getting back into fishing. The first year I went up ice fishing with my brother, after having like a 10 or 12 year hiatus, because we were so busy building the companies, my children were small too, and then they became older. And they became more autonomous, and they didn't, like, they become teenagers and they don't care about you anymore. I mean, they love you, but like, they're like, no, I'm going to hang out with my friends. All right. Everybody was a teenager. They know that happens. And the first year I went up there, I was completely ill prepared. I thought I remembered, you know, all the equipment and the shoes and the boots. And it's cold, you're on the ice and all these things. And that was 2020, went back in 2021, went back in 2022. And this last year, I just felt like a professional. It just felt, but I was like, I was so happy about the failures of the little, all the little things adding up to where it finally made me a success at the end.
I love that. And so the very last question is, we're in Colorado and someone comes up to you at a cafe and they ask you, what are one to three things that I can do now in 2024 to start creating a more fulfilling and abundant life while building up my firm? What would you tell them?
Oh, shut the news off, number one. Shut the news off and don't worry about this macro externality that you can't affect, right? Then after you do that, then I want you to think about what write down, like, if you're into doing push-ups, for example. Okay, you want to start doing it. Great. Write down how many you did on Monday. And then on Wednesday, when you do it again, were you a better push-up guy or gal than the day before? Then take that thinking even further and go, was I a better person just myself than the day before? And that's your number one and your number two goal. After you get into that, a routine of doing those things, of not worrying about these externalities that I can't control, and then only trying to worry about the micro part that I can control, then you're ready for expansion and you can start expanding your mind and expanding the things you can do. And you can start looking into shows like we're doing right here. Those are the three things.
Awesome to hear. And that's a great way to end this episode. Where can listeners keep up with you more?
Well, I will link in with anybody. If they go to linkedin.com and they just type in L-A-N-C-E and then my last name, C-A-Y-K-O, that's L-A-N-C-E-C-A-Y-K-O. I will link in with you all day long. You can go to our website, f9productions.com, sign up for our newsletter. You'll be able to, we put out a newsletter and show everybody all the cool projects we're doing. And then Inside the Firm podcast, please give it a shot. If you're not an architect, totally cool. Then don't listen to the Friday shows. Listen to the Monday shows where I have awesome guests like Julian on. And I have a bunch of other entrepreneurs. We had like John McAfee, remember him, the cybersecurity guy. I interview all kinds of people, left, right, up or down, black, white. All the things I want people, and they're usually start. We usually start with like stories of grit, determination, and positivity.
Yeah, and I will actually co-sign on that too. Actually check out the Friday one, because one of the things I do is actually listen. I get my best ideas to bring back into my own industry by listening to other industries, and so that's kind of one of my tips. I don't listen to too many different like health fitness stuff. I listen to things in architecture. I listen to things. I go to hotels and check out things there because I get inspiration from those things. I just finished a book called Unreasonable Hospitality. It's a very, very, very good book on service and everything. It's had me rethink some things. Mm-hmm. So I would definitely recommend you check those things out. I will have those in the show notes. Thank you so much for joining me. And listeners, once again, stay awesome, be limitless, and as always, go be the CEO of your health and your life. Peace.